Welcome to On Air, a podcast discussion at the intersection of artificial intelligence and international relations, where we will discuss the development of IR theory, law, and practice in the age of AI.
Welcome to the IR in the Age of AI podcast. I'm your host, Medlir Mema. I'm joined today by Dr. Rebecca Dowd, a senior foreign policy and diplomacy service officer at Consulate General of Canada in Dallas, Texas, with expertise over multiple files, including energy, environmental protection and sustainability, and tech industry. Today, however, Dr. Dowd speaks with us in her personal capacity as an academic, scholar, and author of a 2022 publication titled The Birth of Digital Human Rights, Digitized Data Governance as a Human Rights Issue in the EU, which is also the subject of our conversation today. Rebecca, welcome to On Air.
Thank you so much for having me. I appreciate the opportunity to talk about a subject that I thought maybe would go by the wayside eventually, and now it just resurrects itself in a slightly new form in the age of AI.
Well, I think that there's a part of you that wished they would disappear, because I know as somebody who has worked for a long time on one topic that you're like, you don't want to touch that again. You don't want to talk about it again. But yeah, it's here to stay. I think you picked a good topic. So
apparently I picked one with a little stickiness.
Yeah, that's right. Yeah. And I think there's something about this, again, the birth of digital human rights. And we'll get to the topic. What do we mean by digital human rights? But before we do that, combination of academic background, policy, you've done a lot of very interesting things. And a lot of our listeners, some of them graduate students as well, are interested in how you make those transitions. I introduced you as somebody who is actually working in Texas, but for the Canadian government, and you're not Canadian. So
I am not. So like all these things that happen in life, sometimes you end up with an opportunity that you go, this sounds fun. Let's try this.
Yeah.
And that's how I ended up working for the government of Canada. So I have taught at a couple of U.S. universities with specialties and, of course, international relations, EU politics. I've done a little bit of international political economy and then, of course, politics of the Internet. And that's how, of course, my book ties into that with the concepts of online, i.e. digital human rights. Yeah. And I was happily doing that in North Texas and found out about the opportunity to work for the government of Canada in more of a policy analyst role than in my academic work, which is a combination of teaching and research. And I've been doing this now for about 18 months. And it is very fascinating working on the side where you are watching policy get made rather than studying policy post-factoid. So it's not as interesting. And I get to have some really in-depth conversations with different political figures, as well as the business world and the commercial world, because as we know, in international relations, there's honestly not a clear differentiation between politics and trade. These two worlds just overlap so much. And when we're talking about things related to the internet, when we're talking about data brokerage, certainly when we're talking about AI, you cannot separate the corporate from the political anymore.
Well, thank you. Yeah, I think you're absolutely right that at least when it comes to these kinds of issues, there seems to be quite a bit of integration between the two. And I'm sure that will come out also in the course of our conversation. I want to get started with this one episode, which you also mentioned, I think, the beginning of your study. But you start your book with a story of Cambridge Analytica. This is a famous story. Now, why is this episode so important? So maybe for those who perhaps have forgotten the importance of it, but also what does it tell us about the larger story of digitized data as a political object?
Absolutely. So as we all do in graduate school, I was hunting around for my research topic. I'm interested in many things. And this was right in the middle of when we had come out of the 2015-16 refugee crisis in the EU. There was a lot of issues going on in the EU at large. And then they started this conversation and started seeing more and more about this debate on how essentially they were going to police content on the internet, social media content, and then boom, Cambridge Analytica happened. So a quick summary for those that are unfamiliar or those that may have forgotten, Cambridge Analytica was a research body that was created in the UK by some academics, and they created essentially a program that would be a third-party program piggybacking off people's Facebook accounts. And let's say you and I were friends on Facebook. Well, maybe you had this permission on your account to let data be collected, but I didn't. Well, through this program, they could essentially collect my data because we were linked through that social media relationship. And so they were collecting vast amounts of metadata on Facebook users' beliefs, what we were liking, what we were looking at, things we were posting. And this information is utilized essentially for political means. You had some pretty high profile politician of using this, and that's where it piqued my curiosity. Over 80 million Facebook users in multiple countries ended up having their information scraped and collected without their permission, without their awareness. And it was this last fact that created the big legal problem, because why were they allowed to do this? What about the Facebook users agreement? What about the ethics involved with collecting some pretty personal information about people without them knowing about it? And particularly when you had, as we're roaring into the 2024 election cycle, this was, again, utilized by some pretty high profile politicians. For instance, here in Texas, where I am now, Ted Cruz, his campaign actually utilized some of the data from Cambridge Analytica for some of their campaign strategies and targeting and marketing ads and things like this. So it led to a legal discussion, obviously in the UK, in the EU, in Congress. You had different high profile executives with Facebook and some of these other social media companies hauled in front of all these legislative bodies who had some really tough questions for them about the limitations or not that existed around this. And it really opened the door for additional legislation and also conversations about the level of responsibility that these social media companies may have in accountability and transparency with what they're doing. And that's where the notion of digital human rights began to come to the fore for me as a researcher and, of course, somebody that was on the internet like we all are these days.
I am actually intrigued by how recent these developments are. And maybe that's a sign of me getting older. And so this being in my lifetime at these kinds of events. But do you think that this concept of digital human rights and, again, digitized data as a political object, do you think that that would actually predate a lot of this? But as you point out, much of this comes to the fore during this particular time. What do we mean by digitized data as a political object?
Great question. And obviously, as political scientists, we want to be clear about what we're discussing. Right. What is our definition? For me, when I set about looking at this program and what was going on with this company and then the larger group of social media companies in this space, I define digital human rights as this extension of the umbrella of fundamental human rights protections over digitized data that's tied to someone's identity and our behavior. And it can be information that describes our behavior in person, what we're doing in my everyday walk through life, a self or my online persona. And the data that I create when I'm clicking on that cat video, or whether I'm searching for something to buy online, or whether I'm liking something on Instagram or whatever, all of that is compiled and it's collected. And in the early days of digitized data, it was done in very simplistic forms in terms of basically taking what used to be paper-based data, right, and sticking it on computers used by businesses or used by government. Now, of course, it's all cloud-based and it's transmitted through the internet. So it really evolved and just grew exponentially far beyond what anyone could have imagined. And now, of course, we can't think of a world where someone's not collecting data on us for some purpose.
Right. And so it's exactly that collection of data and I guess the problematization of that collection that makes data political. Is that what makes data a political object?
Yeah. So I argue in the book that essentially it becomes a political object because, number one, it's data. It can be data about our political opinions, our political choices, what we're advocating for, what we're pushing against. That's the obvious thing. But also, it can be manipulative, because when you have a Cambridge Analytica situation where the information that's compiled about it. Let's say, for instance, I'll use Texas again, since I live here. Texas is a fairly conservative state. And maybe you've got a politician that's a Democrat and they want to know how to get that messaging through to their base, which is a smaller group of people. They can utilize data that comes from a social media source like this across the state of Texas. They can figure out, based on geolocation, where to throw those ads or where to target those people. Who uses, do the people in Texas, are they Instagram people? Are they Facebook people? Are they Twitter/X people? So now it becomes a tool for political actors to transmit information to the voters, to the constituents, to the opposition, to blast against the opposition, whatever. So this data about you and I, our opinions, where we live, what we think, what we might be worried about in the political realm, it becomes a tool and it's used by political actors.
Well, one of the more surprising, I think, the book is excellent in terms of just the research and I think going back to pulling out these different threads. But the one that surprised me the most, I must confess this, was the fact that it had to do with the role of the European Union, especially against the backdrop of artificial intelligence. We always just sarcastically, jokingly refer to the fact that the Chinese have the data, the Americans have the technology, and the Europeans have the rules. And so we see the European Union very much at the forefront of this attempt to regulate this jungle of artificial intelligence and the new technologies. And so we immediately then acknowledge and I expect that the EU has been playing this role historically. And so when I start reading the book, I'm thinking, yeah, of course, it's going to be a pretty standard story. The European Union leads the path and is doing all this, formalizing all these rules. Well, that's not quite the story. It's more complicated than that. You point out that there were actually three different paths that were available at the front. Actually, the EU initially opted for a data commodification path. Maybe you'll tell us a little more about that. But then there another possibility is data surveillance tool. And then the third one was digital human rights protection. Ultimately, if we give the book away and the story away, we know with GDPR that the EU chose the last path, that it would embody in a way digital human rights protection. But that was not obvious, and that is not how it started. Tell us a little bit about how the European Union becomes this leader when it comes to regulation on digital human rights.
So this is very fascinating. When I started on the journey to try to tease apart how Cambridge Analytica got themselves in such a legal mess, they were in a legal mess because laws existed that essentially there was this question, had they broken these laws, whether it was UK laws or EU laws, US laws, whatever. So you always, as a researcher, you go, okay, at what point do I begin? So I said, I need to go back to the beginning. How far back does this go? We need to tread through all of this. And contextually, you just throw a memory jogger for those of us, again, in the how Cambridge Analytica had longstanding impact. You mentioned GDPR, and that's the end point. But I want to explain something a little bit about that before I get to you further back. So when you and I get on the internet, and we're looking at whatever we're going to look at, inevitably, you have that little pop-up window that's going to ask you, can we collect your data? Do you say yes to cookies or however they phrase it? But it's essentially asking permission for that platform or that site you're on to collect data about what you do there, your practices there. That is a direct result of the GDPR. And as the EU passed that in 2016, in order for companies that are going to contact potential EU citizens or utilize their data or do business online in those spaces, they have to put that up there. So it just became an easy thing. If you're an American company who also happens to do business or has a website accessible in EU, we're going to put it up for everybody because why not have it in both places? So then it gets us off the hook. If we're collecting data on you, whether you're sitting in New York or whether you're sitting in London or wherever it happened to be, because keep in mind at the time, the UK was beginning the process of Brexit, so they were still in. So then we go back to the beginning of this, and I liken this to what the classic political theorist Robert Putnam said, the two-level game. So this happened, it started at the national level amongst a handful of EU states, and then it pushed itself upward to the regional level, the supranational governance that we ended up with. And so I look back, I was like, okay, where was the first place that a law based on identity data came from? And it came from Sweden. They were the first EU state to adopt any digital human rights protection way back in 1973. They passed this thing called the data login. And it was based on this notion. They don't even use the word privacy. What they use is this, essentially this word that existed for over 100 years in their national laws. They call it integritas or integrity. And it's essentially this law that says anything that the government's collecting in the form of data, I can see what they're collecting on me. And this was back 100 years before 1973. We're talking about the 1800s, when the government, everything they collected was paper. Right. So fast forward to the 1960s, 1970s, suddenly the government's taking this data, they're dumping it on computers. Can I see what they're collecting about me? Or because it's no longer on paper, am I going to lose the ability to understand what it is they're doing? So their legislative body passed this law that said, I can still see what the government's tracking on me. And in fact, over time, this law by Sweden served as a template for some other EU countries that were on a similar question of what do we do with this? And of course, the next country that jumped on the bandwagon was Germany. And when you think contextually about Germany, anyone that studies human rights globally, but specifically in Europe, post-World War II, the German governance system has now, it started in West Germany, now, of course, it's unified Germany, but they have been extremely diligent over how they manifest human rights protection, because obviously with the legacy of the Holocaust, they have a lot of desire for clarity and to never get themselves in a situation where this could ever be an issue. So in 1977, they piggyback off of what Sweden does, and they pass this law that is basically, it's called the Bundesdatenschutzgesetz, which, please forgive my bad German, we're going to call it BDSG, but it started at the regional level in Germany, and then it filtered up to the national law. So now Germany's got one, Sweden's got one, and this discussion begins happening, ironically, and not just at the national level, but then you had some multilateral organizations like the OECD comes along, and they're looking at this idea of the commodification of data. All these companies are using data. This is now a new business tool. It's creating business efficiency. It's creating profit models. ICT sectors taking off, and they're encouraging countries to come up with some base work protection that says, if I'm collecting this data, if my companies are collecting this data, I'm going to protect it. I'm going to make sure it doesn't get out, it doesn't get leaked, that it's only used for the purpose for which the original collection designed it for. It's limited purpose, limited use, it's protected, et cetera. So for the most part, OECD members got on board with this, particularly in Europe. The EU was having these discussions at the supranational level. We as a group need to adopt this. We're trying to create this single European market. We're trying to compete against the US that has the first mover advantage when it comes to computer technology, when it comes to the ICT sector. Now, think into the, as we're moving into the 1980s, we're about to get to the point where the internet is going to become a thing outside of government use. And so a lot of interest in not losing ground to the Americans in this space. So a lot of pressure happening there. And the UK was the holdout. And UK, absolutely, at the national level, you had conservative politicians pushing back. You had them pushing back in the EU. And what essentially happened is you had a lot of different MPs trying to introduce in the UK Parliament and therefore get it done in the EU. And until the actual ICT sector went to, at that time, Margaret Thatcher, and said, if you don't pass this law, then our companies will be blocked. And these other European businesses aren't going to want to exchange data with us. And so we are going to cost us money if you don't do this. And then the Thatcher government, as we all know, is very conservative. It was very deregulation, free market economy. Businesses need to have the freedom to do what they want. And suddenly it's put in terms that says, okay, you're actually going to block business trade, international trade, if you do this. So suddenly in 1984, the UK passes it. And that created the finally that tipping point so that the EU now had your big power players. France comes along similarly. I think theirs passed in 1981. So now you have France, Germany, the UK. You have the biggest economies in the EU now adopting this. And again, if we're going to have this cross-border trade that they're pushing for, let's pass something across the board. And they finally did in 1995.
So this is fascinating at so many levels. Again, especially looking at what's going on right now and the role of big tech and efforts to deregulate rather than regulate. And this is the reverse story. And much of that has to do with both the economic, normative, and institutional power of the European Union, or rather of the European Economic Zone, which then obviously would have an impact on the ability, as you point out, of British companies to be able to operate within Europe. And of course, now we've gone back to square one, because with Brexit, we have a similar kind of, and it's just the more things change. It's a very strange thing, but almost it seems like things have shifted. We'll come back a little bit towards the end with the EU AI Act and the role Germany plays there. But here, Germany is in the forefront of these kinds of rules and regulations. Mm-hmm. And now it seems to be trying to spoil at least the current agreement that the European Union has cobbled together. You mentioned how the UK government initially was not optimistic, or rather did not have a positive attitude towards GDPR and its predecessors. What's the US story here? What about the United States, US companies in response to EU's push towards digital human rights?
So that's a great question. And I've puzzled at the difference in a lot of times in terms of political economy. A lot of scholars will compare the UK and the US because we have very similar business model approaches. We're very pro-business. We're very free market trained. Right. All of those things are similar. And the UK ends up in the situation where they have regulations. The United States, ironically, the closest thing we came to passing something, the national laws that the European Union states passed, including the UK, and then even remotely close, was just absolutely not close at all. We have a Privacy Act that we passed in 1973, and basically it says that the government has to protect the data it collects on us. That's it. There is no implication whatsoever that the corporate world has any responsibility over data protection, privacy rights, the limitations on what they're going to use for this data, or anything like that. We did come along a few years later and pass in the 90s, we passed an online act to protect children. So kids under 13, their data is protected. But again, that's basically the honor system, because how many kids lie about their age when they're clicking stuff online? So in terms of the U.S. having domestic laws, it really became more of a state-by-state issue. We can go down that pathway if you'd like and talk about it. But the long story short is that in the absence of federal law, you ended up with individual U.S. states passing their own subnational laws, California and Virginia in particular, that modeled their laws after the laws that were passed in the European Union. And particularly after Directive 95, which was that law that I mentioned, their first EU-based law, and then what became the GDPR.
Right.
There were some attempts to work out this exchange deal. So there was this attempt to say, okay, you, particularly as social media companies come along in the U.S., you have Google and all of that, the social media era that begins, internet takes off in the late 1990s for average consumer use. And then you have social media companies that come along after. But there was a couple of attempts to pass laws that would allow U.S. companies to promise, we're going to provide some protections that line up with the EU law. Some of the listeners may have heard of this. You had the Safe Harbor attempt, and then you had something that was the Privacy Shield. Essentially, these were honor systems that said a U.S. company can sign up to this. I'm voluntarily going to participate in this. I'm going to voluntarily give information to the U.S. government on how I protect the data that I collect. And the U.S. government will keep track of this voluntary contribution of information. But what ended up happening is you had several countries, in fact, cycling back to Germany, you had the regional data protection authorities in the different Länders, the different regions of Germany, come to their national authority and say, U.S. companies are saying they're doing this. German citizens' data is over there. They're not protecting anything. It's leaking like a sieve. And so they pushed back. It became a legal case. The EU Commission took it up, took it to the Court of Justice, and they essentially abandoned the safe harbor. And then in a second legal case, through involving Facebook as a litigant, essentially, abandoned the second model. So they came out right as the GDPR passed and said, we're going to try this again. We're going to pass Privacy Shield. It's going to be better. We're going to guarantee all these safeties. And the Court of Justice says, no, you're not. You're violating it again. And so since 2020, when the most recent ruling came down, there is no agreement in place that says the U.S. is in compliance. The U.S. companies are in compliance with GDPR. And I personally, as someone who watches this, find this problematic because now we haven't solved this baseline issue of digitized personal data. And then we're now going to throw AI into the mix. So this now just compounds what is now going to be a very complicated governance question. Because now it's not just data, it's your identity in multiple ways that can be affected,
or
which is a conversation that can explode.
Yeah, or alternative identity. Before I get to the AI part, on GDPR itself, because this is an issue that you do look at quite closely.
Yeah.
When you look at what the aspirations were and what the content of GDPR is, how well do you think those who came about that actually aim to protect digital human rights, how well have they done? Is this just a piece of paper? Because again, we need to draw lessons about what's likely to happen with the EU AI Act. Or is this actually a pretty good piece of legislation that does exactly what it says? I imagine for most people, our number one relationship with it is having to just say reject all or accept all those very banners that show up. But I imagine it's a little bit more than that. Can you tell us a little bit about aspirations versus outcome?
Yeah, and I think let's go back just a bit to Directive 95, and we'll talk about how GDPR expanded on it. Yeah. So when they passed the law in 95, some of the things that they did that I think we may see come back up when we get to the discussion, meaning the EU, as they discuss out the AI concerns, they defined what these terms are. So they set some clear definitions in the 95 law. What is our personal data? Who is a data controller? What is the scope of protection when it's automatically processed, in quotes? Who is restricted to access? What use can they do? What's the limitations on what they can do with this once they collect it? What about if they anonymize it in some way? Can they use it differently? And one of the things that's really important, and I think that the listeners hopefully will appreciate the gravity of this, and this is where it is a political concern. It's really key in why it was so groundbreaking. They passed the law in 95 to begin with, was they wanted to prohibit personal data collection that touched on issues of race, ethnicity, political, religious, philosophical opinions, trade union membership, your health, or your sex life. Now, these are some really important things if you're talking about a Western democracy that says these are fundamental human rights. In the U.S., we think of the Bill of Rights that essentially flesh these out for us. Right. Many other democracies have similar laws. So the 95 law had this, but this wasn't sufficient to address the grand scope of some of the obligations, because now, again, think about that law was passed in 95. I think Google began something available for general consumers around 98. So this is a pre-Google law. Suddenly you have people on there that can look up anything. People can create content, and the use of data transforms. Social media, of course, does that. And so the GDPR, when they decided to go back in, they kept tacking on all these amendments and like, okay, we'll pass this whole. But they said, this is not good enough. We need to recreate it. And what they did when they recreated it to craft the GDPR, they created Working Party 29, which was a consultancy group the majority of which were attorneys, particularly human rights attorneys. And that's where the stringency and the scope grew beyond what the 95 laws, well, now they're setting differentiation on how long it can be stored, right to be forgotten. If I've committed a crime and I've served my time and somebody Googles me and it says, Rebecca served 5 years for stealing that gum or whatever, I can request that be pulled off the internet. I've done my time. That should be something I can request to be pulled down. So these kinds of things, these kinds of additional protections, as well as obligations for international actors like your Facebook, Google, Amazon, where am I storing the data? Is it stored in the EU? Is it stored in the United States? If it's stored in a data bank, technically data bank, but in a cloud in Ireland, the protections might be different than if it's stored in the United States. And this is where, through the GDPR, the EU is saying, we don't care where it's stored. If you've got EU citizens' data, you better guarantee these protections. And so they now become a norm exporter of digital human rights because they say, you want to do business here, you want to collect our people's information, you're going to follow these rules. And if you don't, we're going to take you to court. And they have. There's been multiple cases that these U.S. companies have gone through court cases for various potential violations of Directive 95 or now GDPR.
Yeah, and this is one of those innovative, in a way, elements of this legislation is, again, going back to that cynical remark about the EU makes laws, but because it doesn't stop just in the EU market, but actually has a lot of influence. And I think we were talking about previously off air about how now even Apple has USB-C ports, and much of that is a direct result of EU legislation. And so American consumers, and not only, but anywhere around the world, are benefiting in a way from these kinds of rules and regulations. You mentioned this confluence of factors like Swedish traditional approach to data protection with integrity, and then the Germans post-World War II type of experience. So the need to also protect their citizens against surveillance and quantification of data. And then once you made the transition from GDPR, where you have these human rights lawyers that come in, there seems to be a lot of contingency involved in the way the GDPR. It's almost a perfect storm in the good sense of the word. And if we just, I guess, prepare to wrap up this conversation, just thinking about artificial intelligence, thinking about the EU AI Act. Just recently, everybody thought the EU AI Act was a done deal, was closed by the end of 2023. Everything should be approved. And then France and Germany and other businesses made several attempts to change key provisions of the act, especially with regards to like ChatGPT-like technology. So they just want to exclude that stuff. And much of it has to do with issues that actually Europeans have often been criticized of, and that is that you're sacrificing the ability to develop your own technologies because you're smothering your own companies with these rules and regulations. And so at least that's the argument that Germany and France are putting forward is that, hey, listen, we need to make sure that we can actually meet the challenges of the time. The United States is leading the way. China's got a bunch of these unicorns. And I think there's one, or if any, within the European Union of these most valuable tech companies. And so this seems, at least the argument is that we need to nurture our own companies, and the EU AI Act is likely to smother that. What lessons can we draw about the role the EU is likely to play in this emerging space of EU of AI governance? And do you think that there may be some post-GDPR schadenfreude, like a little bit of like, hey, this was really good. This was so good that actually did not allow European companies to actually develop. And therefore, the lesson learned here is that we need to just relax a little bit. What's your sense of that?
You mentioned early in the conversation when I looked at the three explanations of why we ended up with a human rights-based model in Europe. And I think we're having some of these same conversations around AI. So at the end of the day, governments collect data about us. They might use it for financial reasons, like are you paying your taxes? But increasingly in a border fluid world, it's a security tool for governments. And so, for instance, here in the United States, post 9/11, we've been using facial recognition tools at the border with Mexico since 2001, 2002. It was an attempt to provide security and safety. Public safety is the number one social contract that every government has, regardless of whether we're talking about democracy or non-democracy. If you can't guarantee public safety, then you're not a functional government. This, as a tool, digitized data and the technology we had back then was potentially a security tool. We talked about the economic factor with, you know, social media companies or other companies. And then we had, of course, the human rights element. I think the core government regulators, and whether we're talking about policymakers, whether we're talking about bureaucrats, the struggle is, how do we define these companies? We still don't know an answer to that here in the United States. What is the quintessential debate about Twitter, i.e. X? The service that they provide, is this a public good? Is this a public platform for free speech? And so they have obligations to allow people to say whatever they want, or do they have some culpability when someone throws hate crime or whatever? We're having the same debate around the tool of AI. So if we're talking about Germany, France, is AI the creative product that comes from these companies? Is this just another commodity that a corporation is creating? Or is this something else, because it deals with identity, whether it's my identity that someone comes out there and puts my face on someone else's body and has me saying things I would never say? Is it stealing my identity from intellectual property theft, stealing my content and using it without attribution or payment? Is it some other issue tied to my identity? We haven't even talked about kids and the effects on kids with the things that can be created. So governments are really struggling. Are we going to treat this as a corporate thing? We need to give them freedom. We are hamstringing our own companies in the global economy, the global digital economy, if we don't give them some leverage here. Or do we treat it like what we should have done with social media, which was set some guardrails to begin with? And I think that what we're seeing right now is that this really is some diversity in opinions on this. Some countries are taking the, it's business, it's just, think of what we can do with this. This is just another tool. And other countries are putting on the brakes. And the interesting tension, I think, is even as we saw, as we're recording this, OpenAI had this big management debacle last week where Sam Altman was kicked out and then he was back. And supposedly the discussion behind closed doors was a matter of ethics. How do we put the brakes on this? Should we slow it down? Should we set some parameters? Even the companies themselves, the people creating this content, don't have the answer to that. So I think that if we're looking about laws going forward, if we're looking about the EU, what are they going to come together on? They were hoping to have the AI Act complete by this month, get it done before the holiday break. Because again, we're doing this in December. I don't know. I don't think they know what they want yet, because there's this internal debate, just like there was with the digitized data to begin with. What do we do with this? Is it an economic commodity? Is this something that's tied to people's identity? And so we need to set some framework on human rights there. How far can governments go to collect this and use this for security reasons? We didn't have time to talk about that here, but I think there are real implications for that here with AI in particular. From that's part of President Biden's AI Bill of Rights to avoid the profiling that can happen through AI is a very real risk, particularly for disenfranchised groups, minority groups, groups that are ethnically tied to some belief system that might make them a target. So this is complicated.
Yeah. No, thank you. And I think we're bringing it back. You mentioned President Biden's initial executive orders on artificial intelligence, and it's clear that the administration wants to be seen doing something. It's not clear to me that it's got what it needs, or the teeth that it needs, because the priority, again, is to provide that leeway, that breathing space to big tech, to private sector. Interestingly enough, in this area, in the area of artificial intelligence, when it comes to governance, and regulations. I expect a lot more from the competition that is currently taking place. And I think, as you point out, the OpenAI leadership debacle was perhaps a reflection of this. But there's some serious disagreements about the future of research and also how far do we want to take this in terms of development, to the degree that some may believe that there are no limits to how far this goes. There's obviously clear disagreements between Larry Page and Elon Musk. I think Elon Musk, this is one of those conversations where Elon Musk is, I think, appears to be more human than the rest of them, even so far as being called.
Okay.
When you have Elon Musk, it's hard to call him a hero, but perhaps like an anti-hero. He's not the villain, but he is.
Yeah. When you have Elon Musk as the moral.
Yeah, the moral center
in the room. That's a little bit dystopian there.
Yeah, so that's right. And that's what I mean. It's the kind of stuff. And it's weird because with the digital human rights issues, which are related, again, this confluence, you have tech companies, like you have governments. You even mentioned the German example. Well, even in Germany, it was a bottom-up from a grounds-up initiative. And here, it seems to be different with artificial intelligence. It seems to be top-down. There's a lot of rules and regulations, but I still wonder what will happen from this fallout, from the clash of titans between the various titans of industry, I think, when it comes to artificial intelligence. It's been a delight. Is there maybe something that to each one close off?
Let me just say, going forward, I would encourage your listeners to watch a couple of things. One, of course, is Chuck Schumer's initiative on the Senate side. So he is taking a multi-stakeholder approach, and that he's involving not just politicians, but I think it's interesting. And this does, encouragingly, in a very polarized U.S., seem like a bipartisan initiative in the sense that you have people on both sides of the aisle bringing in some of these corporate actors, bringing in some of the product creators. And I think that's probably a step in the right direction. What will shape this debate, particularly in the United States, is the result of the 2024 election. So if we end up with a conservative leadership in the White House again, I think that will fundamentally alter the type of regulation goal that the U.S. government sets. Because a pro-business model, typically Republicans are for that. And certainly Donald Trump has this interesting trade philosophy, sometimes protectionist, sometimes they're wide open. So I think just something to watch people going forward in the next 12 to 18 months.
Well, thank you. Trump is such an unpredictable character, so it's hard to see. I think, as you point out, because this is bipartisan at this point in Congress, there's a part of me that thinks that perhaps he'll just let be. I've never seen him have any interest in these kinds of conversations. And this may be one of those areas where he's like, well, Congress, you do your worst and whatever happens. Well, Rebecca, again, thank you for joining us on the podcast. And thank you to all of our listeners. As always, if you like the show, we invite you to subscribe and or leave us a comment. And of course, you can find us on iTunes or wherever you get your podcasts. Also, don't forget to join us for the next episode for a discussion at the intersection of AI and IR theory, law, and practice. Until then, stay human.